Welcome back to DougHammock.com, to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each week to post some thoughts that will get a conversation started about creating a viable, a new, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing hasn't been working, and I do hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment. I want to thank those who have, because at the end of the project, as I've said, I'll turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin with this week's episode. The title is Pornography Really a Problem? This is part one of two. So if you've been paying attention, you know that pornography is everywhere. Depending on how you define it, it's pretty impossible for our children, for us, not to experience it, just living in our society today. So a lot of people have a generalized sense that pornography is not particularly healthy, but it's such a juggernaut industry in our society that its ubiquity has normalized in our mind and in the mind of most young people that it's here and it's here to stay. And that makes most of the arguments against porn sound kind of prudish sometimes. And most folks, they've got a sense that prudishness is not very healthy, so porn becomes kind of a sticky point for a lot of people, especially for parents. So that makes it kind of an easy topic to just not talk about with our young people. In the absence of having a clear understanding or a shared understanding about pornography, that uncertainty often translates into silence. Because it's embarrassing, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable anyway, but that doubly so if we're not sure what we should say about it. But it is the water that our kids swim in, so we can't afford to remain silent. Sometimes we just hope against hope that it doesn't become part of their lives, but there really isn't much hope in that. Sometimes we actually prefer not knowing because bringing up the topic is just so difficult. We sure don't want to say the wrong thing. And for some, the topic can be personally painful. Maybe a husband or a boyfriend looks at porn and it hurts. I've heard from many women how it makes them feel inadequate. What's wrong with me? Why am I not enough for him? For others, it evokes anger or indignation. But it evokes uncertainty. Sometimes it evokes uncertainty because people think maybe porn shouldn't bother me. I mean, I'm pretty sure he's not cheating on me. It bothers me, but maybe it shouldn't. Maybe I am being a prude. On the other hand, maybe I'm allowing myself to be a doormat. Or maybe this is the best relationship that I'll ever have. Maybe this is as good as it gets for me. I wanted someone who would cherish me completely, honor my heart as well as my body, but maybe this is all I'll ever get. So for many, porn unearths questions that go deep in the heart. For some, it's a fear about the relationship. They wonder if they're secure in the relationship. Some wonder if their emotional responses, their own emotional responses to porn, are valid. Is it right to feel these feelings? Is it right to feel this kind of hurt? Is it right to have this sense that I have been measured and found wanting? So for many, we avoid the porn conversation with our young people because it comes with a lot of baggage for ourselves. But again, our young people are immersed in a sea of pornography, and so are we. It's affecting us all. It's impacting our sexual journeys, so we ought to be talking about it, and a lot of people aren't. Now, as I'm writing this right now, the state legislation in Utah is passing a resolution that condemns pornography as a public health crisis. That's the term, public health crisis. Now, opponents to the Utah resolution are calling that kind of an alarmist overreaction. They're calling it an example of how our society stigmatizes sex or sexuality. Now that, in microcosm, what's happening in Utah, embodies the struggle that a lot of parents face. On the one hand, we worry that our kids being exposed to porn is creating a health crisis, a crisis of their well-being. But on the other hand, we worry that we might be having a stigmatized sexual overreaction. So between the pain and the uncertainty, many parents have just adopted a don't ask, don't tell posture. We whistle in the dark, hoping against hope that it's not that bad, or that it's not happening, or that our fears are overblown. It's a cultural confusion, and so it's faced by many in our society. And the net effect is just that we often go silent. It's a conversation with our young people that many times just doesn't happen, or if it does, doesn't go very well. That's a problem. Because the stakes are high on our sex conversations, this one included, and when we go silent, we give our children a disservice. So we'll explore in this episode and the next the simple proposition that we need to talk about porn, that it's a conversation we need to have with one another and with our young people, and that it needs to be a conversation we are comfortable having. It's important enough that we can't afford the conversation to be stilted or uncomfortable. We can't afford the conversation to be a one-time one. So what I hope is that these two episodes will help adults hammer out a framework in their minds and a strategy in their minds that can make them, help them be comfortable having this conversation with young people, and as we've seen, having it early and having it often. So let's see if we can get comfortable with this conversation first by focusing on how not to approach it. That's what we'll do in this episode. We'll look at what is not the problem with porn. We'll explore some of the problems people have with it that aren't really the pressing problems. Now, in the next episode, we'll talk about normalizing the conversation by focusing on things that really are problematic about porn, things that really are hurtful, harmful. Now, when the porn conversation doesn't go well, and it often doesn't, a contributing factor many times is that we avoided having it early on. That means when we have it, it usually happens because we got pushed into having it. We usually have it because something happened. Somebody got caught looking at porn. Somebody left a pornographic image up on their computer. Somebody's credit card shows porn sites on it. And now we have to have the conversation, which means that the very first time we broach the conversation, we are often in reactive mode rather than proactive mode. And that means that the conversation is probably going to start off being super uncomfortable. It's probably going to start off carrying frightened feelings or hurt feelings. It's going to come with a lot of emotion. Sometimes no conversation happens at all. Instead, an internet filter just shows up and the kids never heard a peep. Now, none of those scenarios are particularly helpful. Hurt feelings produced volatile conversations. Fearful feelings produce reactionary conversations. But either way, after the fact, conversations tend to not go that well. They're better than nothing, but they usually require a couple of back up and start again conversations. If we prepare ourselves before we have the after the fact conversation, it really can be helpful. The preparation can help us step back from our reactions, think things through before we begin the conversation. But even better than a thoughtfully considered after the fact conversation is a well prepared before the fact conversation. Like all of our sex talks, the time for the porn conversation is early and often. We approach the porn conversation early and often for the same reason we do that with sex conversations in general, because by normalizing the topic, we open up lines of communication with one another, with our young people. But that's easy to say. It's not as easy to do. So let's talk about some possible strategies that could help us toward the normalization process. To help us normalize these conversations, the one about pornography, one strategy I developed with my own kids, with parents who ask me how to have this conversation, is to start by acknowledging what is so normal about our attraction to porn. Now, as we've seen, we start talking about sex when our kids are young so that by the time we're having the porn conversation, which is about the time they start using a computer for homework, we've already gotten past the awkwardness that comes with just sexual conversations in general. And a good place to start this particular conversation is why porn is such a big thing. Why do human beings like looking at other human beings in sexual situations? Now, when the porn conversations go badly, often the party in the conversation advocating against porn hasn't made a very good case. Often there's an undercurrent to the conversation that doesn't go well that gets influenced by the dirty sex instincts that we saw Western civilization picked up way back in the second century. Often when the conversation doesn't go well, the party that's advocating against porn has been influenced by religious sexual narratives. And as we've seen, religion has held on to those dirty sex distortions longer than about anybody else. So often the conversations will go badly because our instincts get in the way and our instincts betray us and we end up making a bad case. We may not say the words, but sometimes the subtext of the advocating against porn conversation is that human nudity or human erotic desire is somehow tainted or dirty or nasty or embarrassing. Now, of course, we've seen they're not. Now, to be sure, as we'll see in the next episode, it's a little bit naive to think that pornography is merely pictures of nude bodies. In the avalanche that's cascaded through our society these last several decades, defining porn as naked pictures in a centerfold, that is kind of quaint and outdated. But that is where porn began several decades ago. Consequently, it's also where a lot of the parent and child and religious conversations about porn got hammered out. And here we are this many years later, even though porn has so profoundly changed, still hanging on through those decades to the conversations that were hammered out when porn was just pictures of naked women in the centerfold of a magazine. Now, you might be thinking, okay, Doug, making sex dirty or making the naked body somehow embarrassing, no one really thinks that way, but I promise you, many people do. I've been part of a lot of post-mortem discussions after one of these conversations, sex conversations in general, and porn conversations in particular have gone badly. And when they've gone badly, many, many of them begin with the assumption that is often unspoken that somehow the naked body or somehow erotic images are smutty, dirty, nasty. So a good place to start normalizing the conversation about porn is to simply acknowledge that it is not. The problem with porn is not that naked bodies are dirty. If a porn event has not happened yet, we're free to talk about our attraction to the naked body in a non-reactionary way. To find the naked human beautiful is a deeply human trait. Naked bodies touch a deeply aesthetic center inside of us. Now, they also evoke erotic interest, sure they do. But our attraction to the human form has more to it than just that. Our bodies are beautiful, the way that a tree is beautiful, the way that a sunset is beautiful. But our bodies are also beautiful in a much deeper way than a tree or a sunset. In addition to evoking erotic desire, our attraction to the naked body often speaks of a deep human desire for intimacy. Way back in our Judeo-Christian story of the garden, naked, the word, was associated with authenticity and intimacy. Before nudity was associated with shame or embarrassment, our ancient texts used the powerful phrase, naked and unashamed. This simple acknowledgement, that's an important starting place for normalizing the conversation about sexuality in general and pornography in particular. The naked human form evokes a deep longing in the human heart. It is the longing to be naked and to be exposed and to be all out there and to be unashamed. It's a desire to be fully seen, fully known, without humiliation. It's a desire to be naked and exposed and to be safe. That's a primal desire, and it's deep inside of us. Our naked bodies speak of our desire for naked souls. They speak to our desire to be exposed and accepted. Our attraction to the naked form is a window into the deep desire of our hearts. Our bodies act as stand-ins for our souls. Now, in our society, we have a big problem, and it's a huge problem that we have with body image. We don't like our bodies. We're ashamed of our bodies. For us, our bodies share a sense of shame with our souls. When we see ourselves in the mirror, many don't like what we see. Our parts don't look like Michelangelo's David. We don't have the proportions of Venus de Milo. We wish we were less lumpy or more lumpy. We wish we were bigger here or smaller there. And if we were, we think to ourselves, we would be more acceptable to other people, more attractive to other people. We would be more valued, more affirmed, more accepted, safer. The desire for nakedness is deeply connected to our longing to see and be seen, to desire and be desired, to know and to be known, to love and to be loved, truly loved, without qualification, unreservedly, totally. Now, these are complicated impulses that swirl around deep inside us. And one way they manifest is with our fascination with the nude body. It was true for Titian and for the Renaissance painters. It was true for the ancient Greeks and the Romans. And it's true for us today. Nude bodies touch a deep part of us, a primal part of us. It's an attraction that is deeper than just our evolutionary drive to procreate. It's more than the hunger for orgasms. It's more than the hunger for intercourse. It's a desire for intimacy, a desire to transcend judgment and to transcend shame. And that is a deep drive, and it is in us, and it is good. And simply acknowledging that this desire is wired into us and into our children and into our young people, that's an important acknowledgement. An important starting place to normalize these sexual conversations, especially the one with our young people about pornography. It's important our young people do not feel ashamed of this powerful desire inside of themselves. It's a good desire. It's wired into our humanity. Now, later, we'll see how much that the porn that it's consumed today distorts and pollutes healthy sexuality. And later, we'll see how porn often depicts anything but the beauty and the aesthetic of human nudity and sexuality. But our starting place has to be that vigorous sexual passion is not a bad thing, not a dirty thing, not a shame thing. Now, unfortunately, many of the porn conversations that go badly do just that. Their starting point is shame or dirtiness. The problem with porn is not that erotic attraction to nude bodies is dirty. But our attraction to the nude human form, it's not only aesthetic. It's not only about our psycho-emotional desire for intimacy. No, as I said a moment ago, it's also very biological, that attraction. Naked bodies evoke sexual arousal. Now, we are drawn to images of naked bodies, and we are drawn to images of sexual situations because they awaken our erotic drive to procreate. Depictions of nudity and sexual intimacy awaken our drive for intercourse, for orgasm. They awaken raw sexual hunger. When porn conversations go badly, they are often framed by the unconscious instinct that is an attempt to persuade our young people that porn is harmful because erotic awakening is harmful. When conversations go badly, it's the erotic desire itself that is shamed and condemned. But as we've seen in past episodes, you and I are here because we human beings are hardwired for erotic desire. We are hardwired for raw sexual longing. If we were not drawn to naked bodies and that sexual hunger that it awakens, the species wouldn't be here. If our ancestors had not had and then passed on to us the fire of erotic attraction, ours would be a world without people. We're drawn to pornography because it evokes sexual desire. And that is an important foundation for our sex and for our pornography conversations. Sexual hunger is good. The case that we make to our young people cannot be that their sexual hunger for eroticism is bad, that visual arousal is bad. The simple acknowledgement that erotic desire is wired into us and essential for the survival of the species, this is important for normalizing the conversation that we have with our children. Now, to help these conversations go well, it might be helpful to have some background information like discussing how our brains work. When our young people are old enough to understand the basics of brain science, science is our friend. Throughout this project, we've celebrated the evolutionary process that got you and me here. We've honored how profoundly it has shaped how we experience our sexuality. You and I carry in our brains a historical record of the developmental journey that got the human race here. And when we're talking to our young people, we can simplify a lot of neuroscience down to this simple idea. We have two brains, a lower brain and an upper brain. Now, it's three, really. It's a reptilian brain, a mammalian brain, a human prefrontal cortex brain. But for simplicity's sake, when we're talking to young people, we can just talk about two brains. We have one brain that is instinctive. It thinks fast. It reacts. It functions on a before-we-know-it basis. That's the brain that keeps us breathing. That's the brain that keeps us eating and drinking and fighting or flighting. Our second brain is more considered, more thoughtful. It thinks more slowly. It weighs the long-term implications of our words, of our deeds, of our actions. It uses imagination to consider future outcomes. We could call this second brain our make-good-decisions brain. Now, our lower brain, the thinking-fast, reactionary brain, has a simple mandate. Its job is to keep us alive. Its job is to get our genes passed along to the next generation. Survive and thrive, survive and thrive. That's its mission. Breathe, eat, drink, keep moods in balance, mate, procreate. Survive and thrive, survive and thrive. And for goodness sakes, that is an important mandate. The upper brain's mandate is a little more complicated. If you do X, it tells us, the social implications will be Y. If you do X, the future implications will be Z. The short-term gain will be this, but the long-term cost will be that. That's what our upper brain does. Now, as we are normalizing the conversation about sexuality and pornography, it's important to understand that both brains and the mandates given to each one of them are important. Our upper brains remind us that relationships are important. Our upper brains remind us that sometimes our survive and thrive impulses need to be deferred for the appropriate moment so that we can strengthen our relationships. Now, our lower brain wants to eat all the food it can see in case there's a famine that comes up later. So eat, eat, eat. That's what it says. But our upper brain realizes that if we eat all the food in sight and we don't share with other people in the community, our standing in the community will be less secure tomorrow. So our upper brain creates the need for decisions. Which priority will we honor, the immediate or the long term? Which internal drive will we honor? Which one is more important in this moment, in this situation? Shall we look at the long-term implications of this decision, or shall we go with the simpler, instinct-driven, survive and thrive impulse? So, our two brains set us up for an ongoing human dilemma. It's a dilemma which, throughout history, we speak about in a lot of different ways. Sometimes we call the lower impulses vices, and we call the upper impulses virtues. Sure, we've done that. Sometimes we frame our two brain impulses as evil versus good, or sinner versus saint, or corruption versus perfection. And we tend to be pretty hard on our lower brains. That lower brain, it just sits down there doing its job, keeping us alive, keeping our genes getting passed into the offspring, keeping us nourished and hydrated, keeping us motivated, keeping us sexually energized enough to fulfill our duty to the species. But for all the good it does, we tend to value the work of the upper brain much more highly. We tend to honor the work of our prefrontal cortexes over the work of our survive and thrive impulses. So, our upper brains will often tell our lower brains, if you eat those evolutionarily successful foods, you're going to get fat, so don't do it, dummy. If you heed that ancient sexual drive, that ancient sexual impulse, you're going to break an important social contract, so don't do it. Stop it. Shape up, lower brain. Fly right. Be strong. Don't be weak. Be good. Don't be evil. Be a saint. Don't be a sinner. And at first, our lower brains will accommodate us. They'll go along. They'll back down and say, okay, I'll forego that impulse, upper brain. I'll not follow that instinct. You win. You're smarter after all, whatever you say. But the problem is, the lower brain is really old. In the history that got us here, it came a long time before the upper brain. Its mandate not only came first, it really is the most important. If we don't honor the survive and thrive impulse, we're not here. The lower brain was around working its mandate, keeping us alive long before the upper brain showed up with its clever, enlightened way of thinking. The lower brain's instincts were honed over a long, long time, and they are really good at helping us survive and thrive. Obviously, we're here. They worked. So for all the moralizing wisdom of the upper brain, the lower brain won't be thwarted over the long run. It won't really matter if our upper brains say sex is dirty, or if our upper brains say comfort foods will make you fat. If we don't honor the needs of the lower brain, it will eventually begin to ignore the upper brain. If we don't take care of our impulse-driven needs, our survive and thrive needs, the lower brain will eventually rebel and take over. That's why we can usually only diet for about 6 weeks before the wheels fall off the bus. The lower brain isn't as smart as the upper brain, but it is much more tenacious. When it takes over and starts to run things, we eat the cookie, we get fat, damn the consequences. When the lower brain takes over and starts to run things, we act on the sexual impulse, we harm the social network. Now, the upper brain sees the messy problem and reacts with all kinds of rebuke. Sinner, the upper brain says, evil, bad. The upper brain tries really hard to strengthen its grip on things. But if the needs of the lower brain are not considered and taken care of, all of the heavy-handed moralizing in the world is for naught. It just doesn't work, and it never will. The lower brain has a job to keep the species alive, and thank God it will not be thwarted. So the wisdom of history, and the wisdom of religion, and the wisdom of the therapeutic sciences is that we get our best outcomes when the upper and the lower brain negotiate a way forward together. When they negotiate a way forward that honors the role that both play. When we honor both our primal needs and our instincts, we give ourselves the best practice possibilities that give us the best possible outcomes. Now, all that as background, porn is one of the places that we often miss the necessary interplay, the necessary balance between our two brains. If we honor the lower brain functions without reference to the higher, our sexual energies are spent without the benefit of the big picture that we'll look at in the next episode. Our sexual energies are spent without reference to our long-term well-being. Conversely, if we don't heed the primal instincts of our ancient needs, we set ourselves on a fool's errand. Our primal drives will achieve their end. We can berate the lower brain, we can ignore it, we can invalidate it if we wish, but it will enact our most ancient instincts. It will find the internal equilibrium we need. It will achieve dopamine balance. It will serve its function. But we don't usually negotiate for the well-being of both brains. What we usually do is fall back into upper brain prejudice. Shape up, lower brain. Line up, lower brain. Bad, bad lower brain impulses. Do what I tell you to do, and do it because I said for you to do it. Now, when we talk to young people about pornography, especially when church folk have the conversation, the basic outline of our input to them is often this: porn is bad. Don't do it. Now, sure, you have a deep draw to intimacy and to the nude human form. Sure, you've got powerful sexual urges that drive you toward the nude human form, but stop it. Don't look. It's bad. It's ill-considered. Again, stop it. Now, I want you to note what I'm not saying. I'm not saying porn isn't a problem. It often is, and we're going to look at the problems. It's just not that problem. Porn is not a problem because it's dirty or instinctive. Porn is not a problem because it's evil or wrong, because the human drive for beauty is not dirty, the human drive for intimacy is not dirty, and the drive of the lower brain and the impulses and instincts that cause us to survive and thrive and procreate and get our genes passed on, these are not bad. And when we carry the unconscious assumptions that these things are bad, our conversations about pornography don't go well. Porn is not a problem because sexual imagery evokes such a deep place inside of us. Porn is not a problem because our fiery drives for the erotic and for intercourse and for orgasm are bad. Porn is not a problem because lower brain instinctive raw sexual desire is bad. And if we make the case to our young people that it is, and we don't take into account the fundamental realities of both brains, we might as well not talk to them. Because their lower brains won't listen, but eventually neither will their upper brains. But we can do better. There is a case to be made, a better case. But a good place to start is by opening up the conversation in non-reactive, proactive ways, and to think out loud with our children about how nudity and sexual images awaken our drive for intimacy, and to think about how they awaken desire, the very desire that got the human race here, and by thinking about how our brains work. Now, as I said, in the next episode, we'll think together about things that do make porn harmful. But to help us have that conversation, we need to bring a shared understanding about what we're not saying when we make the case that porn is harmful. And hopefully these three starting points can help. All right, we'll pick up here next time. But before then, I'd love to hear what you're thinking. Did you grow up with the "it's bad, stop it" case against porn? And if so, how did it go? Or did you grow up with a "nothing wrong with it" framework? And if so, how did that go? I'd love to hear from you. You can post on the Facebook page or on the blog, either one. Next time.